Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. Following President Obama's major address on the economy yesterday, we'll begin with an analysis of the battle ahead between an aggressive Republican Congress determined to push through radical cuts that will not only shred Obama's programs and priorities, but will gut government itself. Richard Parker, a professor of economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, joins us to assess the battle ahead that will either result in a reversal of economic injustice or the complete capture of America by the 1%. Then we'll look into last night's very close 217-205 vote in the House that killed an amendment to curb the NSA's authority under Section 215 of the Patriot Act to gather metadata on American citizens. Heidi Boghossian, the executive director of the National Lawyers Guild and author of Spying on Democracy, Government Surveillance, Corporate Power, and Public Resistance, joins us to discuss the alliance between Tea Party Republicans and progressive Democrats, who narrowly lost to a coalition of the NSA, the White House, and the minority and majority leadership of the House. Then finally, we will examine the implications of the indictment today of SAC Capital Stephen Cohen on insider trading and whether prosecuting a hedge fund billionaire represents the end of the too-big-to-jail phenomenon that has characterized the lackluster performance of the Justice Department under Lanny Breuer, which has not gone after anyone on Wall Street responsible for the 2008 crash. Veteran financial reporter William Cohan, the author of Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World, joins us to look into the hedge fund business. And joining us now is Richard Parker, a professor of economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and a senior fellow at the Shorenstein Center. He is a former managing editor of Ramparts and was co-founder of Mother Jones magazine and currently serves on the editorial board of The Nation. His books include The Myths of the Middle Class and John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, His Economics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Richard Parker.
Good to be with you again, Ian.
And the president made a stirring speech yesterday talking about trying to reverse the growing inequality in this country. And he said that he would devote the rest of his term, in effect every waking minute, to try and make America work again for working Americans. At the same time, the House have come out with this massive broadside against government itself, not just everything Obama's tried to do and has achieved. It's extraordinary. I mean, I can go through the list. So it seems like a battle is ensuing, but what do you think of the battlefield in terms of how the forces are arrayed? Does the president have some wind at his back?
I think that he's in a better position now than he's been in for a long time, and I think he and his advisors, I think, rightly recognize that right now is a very good time to get on top of this particular message. He's been blown off it by a number of other issues, whether it's been Snowden or Newtown or any number of other things, none of which is small or unimportant issues, certainly. But the overwhelming concern of Americans is about jobs, income, security, and the economic future of their families, themselves, and the country as a whole. And I think that, you know, if Obama is going to be the agent of change that he billed himself as in running the first time, and I believe disappointed many of his own supporters over the course of his first four and some years in office, this is his opportunity to redefine his presidency. And I think that there are multiple levels for us to believe that this may, in fact, be a moment where he can actually sail with the wind.
So do you think there's a way, I mean, he gets, from the right, he's attacked in the most vicious and almost irrational way. There's a poisonous hatred out there that's quite shocking and a disrespect that is almost unprecedented on the right. And then there's equally on the left, there's a lot of disillusion. And I'm just wondering whether the White House will, I mean, in many ways, the unfortunate thing about the Democrats is that their best arguments often running against the Republicans is that we're not them. And in this case, I think you've got a strong argument here in terms of we're not them. I'll just quickly go through some of the proposals here in the GOP's new budget offensive in terms of cuts. They want to cut the Environmental Protection Agency budget by 34% and the Clean Water budget by 83%, Fish and Wildlife by 27%, education grants to poor students by 16%, the Labor Department by 13%, energy efficiency and energy conservation programs and renewable energy, cut them all together. This is, by the way, the deficit hawks. They want to cut the IRS, which collects revenues, by 24%, and they want to cut the Securities and Exchange Commission that oversees Wall Street and presumably takes care of investors by 18%, and it goes on. So, I mean, have you seen anything like this?
Well, I mean, we do have the Roosevelt era, we have the Truman era, we have the Kennedy era, we have the Johnson era. I wasn't old enough to live through the Roosevelt era, but I was alive for the others. And, you know, the hatred of a certain kind of conservative in America is a fixed star in American politics. I think that issues changed somewhat over time, but they come back to a central hatred of government. And below that, you know, what Mitt Romney called the 47%. And yet again, I think that what we've got right now is a moment of defining sort of the master narrative that will shape this debate over the next 20 years. And I don't think the Republicans are situated well to take advantage either of the demographic change or of the psychological change that will come as we do begin to slowly experience recovery. That when people recognize that their lives and their futures are not going to be benefited by the kind of austerity and the kind of mean-spiritedness that this sort of Republican agenda represents, I think that it incrementally shifts the argument away from them in ways that they are the last to understand. I don't think that it has registered on them how deep a hole they've gotten themselves into, how their division and their smallness have hurt them over time. Whether it's California, which is a non-white majority state, or emerging states like Texas, where I think that this on-the-ground campaign that the Democrats are throwing into Texas will begin to bear fruit. I think that we're going to see a change that reflects that this is a new America emerging. This is wave three of a history of American migrations that have changed the fundamental politics of American life every time that it's happened. And I don't think that they're going to be able to ride this out in a way that's going to work for them as a party. They're going to have to bend to the change, not the change bend to them.
Again, I'm speaking with Richard Parker, who's a professor of economics and public policy at Harvard Kennedy School of Government and a senior fellow at the Shorenstein Center. He is a former managing editor of Ramparts, was co-founder of Mother Jones magazine, and currently serves on the editorial board of The Nation. His books include The Myth of the Middle Class and John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, His Economics. Now, so much of the anti-government message and the libertarian message is financed through think tanks by some of the billionaires, the Koch brothers and others, and some of these are quite bilious, and it's pretty clear that their agenda is to get rid of regulations, like getting rid of the EPA, I imagine, is a cherished dream of the Koch brothers. So it's not hard to understand why a lot of powerful business interests want government weakened or even to disappear in a kind of libertarian wet dream. But on the other side, there isn't really much of a vigorous defense of government itself. And we don't have the culture of a social democracy here in the United States where you understand the transaction. You pay your taxes and you get government services in return. And, you know, the argument is always about big government, not about better government and more responsive government. And I'm just wondering whether, you know, I'm a little bit, there's a little bit of hope in terms of that argument coming forth with people like Elizabeth Warren and the perennial Bernie Sanders, who seem to be champions of the average American. But do you see any way or any possibility that we can have a better debate about what can be done in terms of improving government as opposed to leaving the field open to the Koch brothers and their hirelings in the think tanks and in the press?
Sure. I mean, look, there's a long history of very wealthy industrialists of different sectors financing the campaigns of right-wing politicians. I mean, William Jennings Bryan was defeated in 1896 by William McKinley in no small part because of unprecedented levels of donations that came from Rockefellers and steel magnates of the time. That, there's nothing new about that history. In the 1930s, there was a group called the Liberty Lobby, that, or there was the National Association of Manufacturers, or there was the Chamber of Commerce as a kind of perennial that has been there for the last 80 or 100 years. And in the 1950s and 60s, we had right-wing Texas oil millionaires like H.L. Hunt, for example. I mean, the Koch brothers are a kind of perennial in American politics. The role of the extremist multimillionaire, or these days billionaire, is not a new one in American life. The trick has always been to form a political consensus that overwhelms them in terms of their ability to get done what they think money ought to be able to do in a democracy. So, you know, I'm trying to read it at a more fundamental demographic and political period level. The demography is one that I think has been commented on by many people over the last several years, and I think that it's fundamentally a true understanding that you can't expect that a country that isn't trying to incorporate a vast new wave of immigrants, and that is wrestling with a history of race and the consequences of race and the ways that it is going to remain static and enthralled to a handful of white male right-wing billionaires. The second is that American politics follows long cycles, and we had a long cycle that ran from the 1930s up to the 1970s, and that in its post-war iteration was perhaps the most egalitarian and most economically successful period in American life. And we've now run a long period from the 1930s up to the present, in which the dominant narrative has been that of market over government. But I just don't see that as a narrative that has a lot of traction going forward. You don't see its appeal outside of the readouts of ultra-conservatism, where it has always historically had a sway. I mean, I think that that's where you have to look at political cycles and demography in conjunction with one another and recognize that we are actually moving toward a period where, to the degree that the White House and the president use the bully pulpit of the White House to rally the arguments so that the valences of the arguments are those that are being set out essentially by Obama now, that when that happens, people like us and values that we care about begin to win. Now, does that mean that Obama has the kinds of majority in Congress that Franklin Roosevelt had or that Lyndon Johnson had in the mid-1960s? Not at all. I mean, one of the things that I fault critics of Obama for is that they've imagined that Obama could, whatever the size of his majorities in Congress, make happen what he wants simply because he's articulated. But, you know, you've got a White House and you've got a Senate that are both controlled by Democrats, and you've got a Republican House, but you've also seen the president become increasingly ingenious in the ways that he's willing to work around the House to get things done. And this is the second part of that campaign, which is to now begin to campaign on the larger valence issues of our times and force the Republicans to respond on terms that are controlled by the Democrats, not vice versa. So the fact that the Republicans are responding as they are doesn't, in fact, say anything to me other than this is a measure of growing desperation as they try to hold their coalition together, even as history's tides are moving away from them.
Well, there may be desperation on the Republican side, and they may see the demographic clock ticking, but boy, they've pulled off some very powerful moves to ensure the, for example, unlimited money pours into their coffers with the Supreme Court decision. And that's difficult not to see. In many ways, it seems that the Chief Justice, John Roberts, is one of the Republicans' best strategists. He has a long view. I mean, if you get rid of the Voting Rights Act, which they've just done, you saw the next day almost a plethora of voting restrictions to stop.
Well, and again, now you have to remember, though, I mean, this was one of the great issues of the second term of Roosevelt's presidency, in which his pressure to change the Supreme Court's utterly reactionary series of decisions on the New Deal, while it led to a defeat for Roosevelt overtly, nonetheless did have the impact of altering the court's voting behavior over the next 3 or 4 years in a way that was far more favorable to President Roosevelt and the New Deal than it had been in the first term. And again, You know, I read these decisions on DOMA and the Voting Rights Act as this very conservative court trying to not get so far away from where it sees the mood of the country heading that it disqualifies itself as a branch of government. So, I mean, again, you know, I read some of these recent decisions as an ultra-conservative court itself sensing the winds of change and trying to hold on to a conservative agenda, but not so paid itself into a corner that it finds itself isolated as the third branch. So I guess I'd interpret some of this a little bit differently. I also think that, you know, we are going to have more seats on that court opening up, and it's going to be a battle for every one of them. But I'm old enough that I don't actually think that the Roberts Court will exist forever any more than I could imagine that the Warren Court would exist forever. And I do think change is in the offing, and it's not toward more conservatism on the court, it's toward less.
But a lot of analysts, Richard Parker, say that this particular period of gridlock where the Congress has an 8% approval rating, and most people, I think, see this as being absolutely entrenched. And we have another debt ceiling battle coming up where all of those cuts that I talked about, they may well use that mechanism to enforce those cuts or to extort those cuts. So we have and I'd like to get your historical perspective on how terrible the gridlock is compared to how it's been before. And it seems to me that the only way that you'll ever get a more representative government, a majority government, because of the filibuster that's been used in the Senate, for example, would be for Obama to win, or for the Democrats to win in 2014 and to take back the House and to hold on or, in fact, increase their majority above 60 in the Senate. And then you wouldn't have to deal with this constant guerrilla war that's going on. That seems unlikely, doesn't it?
In numerical terms, I absolutely agree with you, Ian. And again, where I weigh in on this whole middle-class speaking campaign that the president's engaged in is that I think he's doing the right thing by trying to establish the terms of debate. If what you've got is a fairly highly abstractive set of questions about fiscal versus monetary policy, quantitative easing versus austerity, you've actually left, I think, a majority or a substantial minority of the American populace on the sideline because they don't feel either technically competent to engage in that debate or they simply don't understand the terms of the debate. I think that if what you can do is follow the White House's lead to shift this onto the question of what kind of middle-class America do we want going forward, what kind of opportunities do we want for ordinary citizens, you actually move the debate onto terms where the Democrats in the White House are in much, much better position to win.
Well, Richard Parker, I thank you for joining us. I'm feeling a little better.
Well, I don't want you to feel too good. We haven't won yet.
Oh, I agree. But it's just with the gerrymandering, with the filibuster, with Citizens United, with the striking down of the Voting Rights Act, you feel, and with this aggressive agenda of the House GOP in terms of cutting the government or gutting the government, you just feel like the other side is not stepping up to the plate, you know.
Well, I hear two things. One of the things is think about the Voting Rights Act. What's happening is that a terrible unconstitutional thing is happening, which is the disenfranchisement of non-white Americans, but most of it is occurring in states that the right has the ability to control for an indefinite future, and that in those states outside that particular zone of their control, that's where the battle takes place. And I think that's where the damage done by this reconsideration of the Voting Rights Act is going to have much less impact because I think it actually energizes voters to turn out. That was the remarkable thing about the 2008 election and even about the 2012 election, which was given a candidate, given a message, people who don't vote, vote. And I think that all the Voting Rights Act revisions, all the attempts at limiting voter registration or the rights of people to vote without the very narrow definitions of identification, all those get overwhelmed if, in fact, people who haven't historically voted because they haven't felt hope feel that there's some possibility because the president and the White House are talking in terms and talking about them in ways that they understand.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Richard Parker.
As always, it's good to talk with you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Richard Parker, who's a professor of economics and public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and a senior fellow at the Shorenstein Center. He's a former managing editor of Ramparts, was co-founder of Mother Jones magazine, and currently serves on the editorial board of The Nation. His books include The Myth of the Middle Class and John Kenneth Galbraith, His Life, His Politics, and His Economics. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the close vote last night in the House to stop the NSA from spying on American citizens.